from WNYC in New York. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone.
So in love with you.
That's President Obama impressively on key. This week, the Romney campaign sampled that footage in an attack ad, saying that Obama's love is directed at his well-heeled Washington cronies and fundraisers. It was Romney's retaliation for Obama's attack ad last week, accusing the warbling Republican of outsourcing jobs in his private sector days. This week, we start with money. Who's got it, who's spending it, and how much they should be required to reveal about it. Romney's camp charged that the president was rewarding his fundraisers with jobs and stimulus money. But how are we to know that Romney's backers are not similarly advantaged? Here's how. Romney's advisor Ed Gillespie said in a conference call with reporters, quote, "Governor Romney's contributors are made public, they're disclosed, and we're going to continue to do that," unquote. So, who's more transparent? This week, the candidates are making that the big question. And yet Tuesday, the Disclose Act, which would have allowed you to better know the people behind super PACs, was smothered in the Senate by filibuster without earning a single Republican vote. The Huffington Post's Dan Frumkin has been following the Disclose Act. Dan, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
I know maybe it's wrong to ask this of a Huffington Post reporter, which is, you know, an avowedly liberal organization, but help me parse Ed Gillespie's statement. Gillespie must be pointing to some opacity in Obama's campaign that Romney doesn't have.
The thing that has been very confusing to reporters covering politics these days is that sometimes people will say things that are just not true. And reporters have a hard time figuring out what to do with that. Both campaigns, by law, must disclose the donations that go directly to their campaigns. Neither is obliged to disclose what we call bundlers, which is people who are responsible for bundling all of these contributions. President Obama's campaign does disclose those bundlers, which is why a Romney ad can point out who his bundlers are.
Mm-hmm.
Mitt Romney does not, however, disclose his bundlers. So in that sense, Romney's campaign is absolutely less transparent than Obama's. Republicans have traditionally actually favored disclosure. They have said, don't put limits on campaign spending, but just disclose everything. If everybody knows where the money is coming from, there can be no corruption. That was absolutely the Republican Party line. And it was up until basically a couple of years ago when the Republican Party's political prospects were very much tied towards the enormous amounts of money that corporations were willing to give them as long as nobody knew that they were giving it. And that's why Republicans have en masse refused to allow this Disclose Act to go through. And you have Mitch McConnell saying with a straight face that the reason he's against disclosure is because it stifles the First Amendment.
But the ACLU, not frequently in bed with Republicans, has also opposed it because it extends the period that issue advocates would have to be disclosed. Let me quote from the ACLU's letter. Organizations would face two unsatisfactory choices: protect the privacy of their donors by refraining from issue advocacy, or give up the privacy of their donors and place at risk the opportunity for additional donations by those supporters.
But the point is that nobody in this country, not people, not corporations, not people corporations, has a right to anonymous political speech. That has never been established by anybody. The only exception to that has been in cases like the NAACP in the 50s, where if the members of the NAACP had been exposed, they would have been actually subject to enormous personal risk.
Right. The ACLU cites that case of the NAACP versus Alabama, and I quote, "The lessons of that time must not be lost simply because today's causes are different from those of the civil rights era."
I simply cannot respond to the ACLU letter because I have not seen it. I can tell you that Karl Rove has been making the argument, likening his billionaire corporate donors to members of the NAACP. And I think, frankly, that argument is obscene. If you were outed as a member of the NAACP in the 50s, you could have gotten killed. This is a protection intended for the powerless, not for the already extraordinarily powerful.
You know, the weird thing is that this flood of anonymous political money has been the result of the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision that affirmed that money is speech. But in that decision, the court also suggested that Congress pass a law requiring more disclosure of donors.
Precisely. Congress has specific categories for groups that are involved in politics, and all of those groups must disclose their donors. What's happening here is nonprofit groups organized under, in one case, a section of the IRS code for what's supposed to be social welfare organizations. That's what Crossroads GPS, you know, Karl Rove's group is. Or it's supposed to be trade associations like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. They are being used instead as conduits for vast amounts of money into campaign ads. Those are just loopholes that need to be fixed. And that's what the Disclose Act was trying to do.
Freedom of information is pretty crucial to our program. It's rare that it gets to the top of the political agenda. Do you think that this is going to have any legs?
What's possible is that as we get closer to the election, especially in the swing states, which will be completely inundated by vicious attack ads that are paid for primarily with secret money, the public will get a little ticked off. And I think the Democratic strategy is probably to take the anger against attack ads, which comes up every election, and actually direct it a little bit more at the Republicans, when, of course, you know, both parties are responsible.
People say that they hate attack ads, but...
They work.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Dan Frumkin is the senior Washington correspondent for The Huffington Post.
I've already put out 1 year of tax returns. We'll put out the next year of tax returns as soon as the accountants have that ready. And that's what we're going to put out. I know there will always be calls for more.
Calls continued this week for Mitt Romney to release more tax records. Among his critics, editors of the National Review predicting he would eventually have to cave. Why? Because tax record releases are something of a campaign tradition, inaugurated by a vice presidential candidate who was suffering some trust issues back in 1952.
It was a little Cocker Spaniel dog, black and white, spotted. And our little girl, Tricia, the six-year-old, named it Checker.
In Richard Nixon's famous Checkers speech, he promised to address reports that he had received improper gifts, but he'd never return the dog.
Now, that regardless of what they say about it, we're going to keep him.
In addition to this bit of adorable political theater, Nixon went over his finances, how much money he had, how much his house was worth, and he urged his Democratic opponents to do the same.
The United States must have the confidence of all the people. And that's why I'm doing what I'm doing. And that's why I suggest that Mr. Stevenson and Mr. Sparkman, since they are under attack, should do what they're doing.
Joseph Thorndike, the director of the Tax History Project at Tax Analysts, is with us now. Joe, welcome to OTM.
Well, thanks for having me.
That's quite a specialty you've got.
You know, if you find the small enough pond, it's easy to be the big fish. So.
So can you tell me what the impact of Nixon's Checkers speech was?
Well, you know, the immediate impact was that Nixon actually got to keep his spot on the Republican ticket that year.
But was that because of the dog or the disclosures?
Well, Nixon was never really at his best on TV, but, you know, he said, my wife doesn't have a mink coat, but she has a good Republican cloth coat. So it served its immediate political goal of sort of saving his skin. In a broader sense, it did start getting people to think about financial disclosure by candidates, but it really took until the late 60s. Before it became a routine sort of thing.
But there's no standard as to how much.
There really is no standard. If you look back over the last several decades, what you find is some have released 30 years of returns and some have released just one. Candidates, and for that matter, presidents, have a protection for their tax privacy just like every American does. The IRS can't release any information about any of our taxes without our permission.
So how much has Obama released?
I think he's released back to 2000, and that's fairly typical. Now, what you often see is that how much tax disclosure a candidate offers depends on what their political situation is. So Obama released a lot of returns when he was in the Democratic primaries against Hillary Clinton, and he wanted to pressure her to release more returns. He was trying to embarrass her. So people tend to release a lot of data when they feel like they can get some political advantage out of that.
When John Kerry ran in 2004, he was quite open about his own finances, but he drew the line at his millionaire wife's.
Spouses do turn out to be a problem here. I mean, this goes back as far as Geraldine Ferraro when she ran as Mondale's running mate. Her husband didn't release any tax information, and that was quite a controversy at the time. John Kerry had that problem with his wife, and actually John McCain had that problem with his wife.
Now, there are already mandatory disclosures for presidential candidates that give us some insights into how much money they have. So what can you learn from tax returns that you can't learn from what they are legally mandated to provide?
I think the real issue here is that it can tell us whether they're walking the walk. And they'll all get up and say, oh, I'm against tax avoidance. You know, I think everybody should pay their fair share, blah, blah, blah. The question is, how do you comport yourself when people aren't looking? And that goes to the heart of someone's character. I think that the American people have a right to know that.
People who disagree with you argue that the requirement to disclose tax returns going back X number of years might discourage people from entering politics, not just because it would reveal possibly their own dirty underwear, but also that of their families and friends.
They have already compromised their own privacy and that of their family and friends when they decided to run in the first place. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're filing financial disclosure reports with the Federal Election Commission that are arguably much more invasive than a tax return. So we may think, oh, past candidates would never have been able to survive this. Could John Kennedy have survived this kind of scrutiny? Maybe not, but you know what? It's all beside the point. Long ago, these guys decided that their life was going to be an open book. I think we should just solve the problem, require these guys to staple their return to the back of their FEC disclosure, figuratively at least, and just put it out there.
This character argument, you mentioned John Kennedy. He would not have survived inquiries into his personal life either. Do you think all that stuff should be stapled to the back of an envelope?
I just don't think you can turn back the clock on this. We might all wish we lived in a more genteel era, but I don't know what we're clinging to here. That era is long since gone.
Joseph, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Joseph Thorndike is the director of the Tax History Project at Tax Analysts and a contributing editor for Tax Notes magazine.
Coming up, campaigns demand the right to launder quotes before news outlets can use them. And news outlets roll over.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the internet. More at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. We're continuing with the theme of disclosure, or the lack thereof. You can try to find out the people behind the super PACs, but good luck with that. And most people don't have the time to figure out what a lot of those PACs with impenetrable names like Americans for America actually stand for. Enter the Super PAC app. Simply play the audio of an ad into your smartphone, and the Super PAC app will provide a wealth of information about the ad and the group that produced it. It will even fact check. Dan Siegel created the app with Jennifer Hollett. He says that all you have to do is hold your phone up to the TV while an ad is playing. That provides a sample of audio.
And then we match that against a database we're creating of all the ads. And then once the ad is identified, the user is served up with contextually relevant content about that ad. So the first screen is basic information like who is behind this ad, how much money have they raised, how much money have they spent in this campaign so far. And there's an opportunity as well for the user to actually vote on the ad. And then once they do that, they are able to see how other users have voted on that ad.
Now, in the introduction, we said that the app even fact-checks claims. That's not quite right, but it does link you to fact-checks by third parties that have been done on a given ad.
Yeah, what the app is not going to do is say true or false, you know, once you hold it up to the ad. But rather, what it will do is say claim X was made in this ad, and here are a few trusted, nonpartisan sources that have precisely talked about claim X. But really, the goal here is to tell users that you don't have to sign up for 3 hours of homework every night and Googling and reading every blog just to get basic information about the ads that you're watching. We'll put this tool in your hands and allow you to find this information right at the moment that you're actually watching the ad.
It seems to me that the audience for this is pretty much limited to those already trained to understand that you cannot take political advertising at face value. that this app will serve the most, I guess, enlightened part of the electorate. Is it going to make any difference?
We hope it goes beyond the folks who are already inclined to dig up this information, because there's going to be a ton of money into this election. You know, the estimate that we've read is $11 billion, and a lot of that is coming from organizations that never existed before. So really what's going to happen, which is going to be unprecedented, is that particularly in swing states, sometime mid-August, late August, there's going to be no more Tide commercials, no more car commercials. It's going to be all political commercials. And if there's a tool that can present that information to the user, you know, we're hoping we're reaching beyond just the folks who would already be inclined to dig this information up themselves.
Now, Dan, it's the middle of July. The election is coming right up. Where the hell's your app?
The app is going to be available for download at the end of August, and it's going to be timed for the first convention, which is the RNC convention in Tampa.
Permit me to make a little prediction here. And that is that you do this thing, you get it up and running, and just sort of in the nick of time. And it, in fact, does have no impact on the previously stated grounds, that it's just helping the people who are most informed and enlightened to begin with. But maybe as this kind of technology coalesces, someday this will be standard for just regular civilians to do due diligence on the claims that are coming out of their TVs?
First, I hope the premise of the question is wrong, right? I hope that it's not just the upper crust of folks who are already plugged in using the app. But to your second point, yeah, there's certainly things we've thought about what we can do with this after, and one of those that Jen and I have talked about is applying this, as you said, to any product-based commercial. And so if you're watching a commercial for a drug or a car or a shampoo, and it makes a claim about that product, we can get users in the habit of saying, well, I know how to check that in real time.
Dan, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It was great speaking with you.
Dan Siegel with Jen Hollett is the creator of Super PAC app. The revelation in the New York Times this week was, to quote Dan Rather on the subject, jaw-dropping. Washington reporters covering the presidential campaign and other inside the Beltway beats routinely send quotes back to their sources for approval. It works like this. An Obama campaign official, say, gives an interview on background. That means nothing can be attributed to him or her unless the reporter can persuade the source after the fact to go on the record. On background is sketchy unto itself, but an age-old practice. The twist revealed in the Times was that as reporters write their stories, they submit the specific quotes they want to include back to the source for approval. The campaigns then clean up the quotes to denude them of anything potentially detrimental to the campaign. Washington reporting is well known for permitting varying degrees of subterfuge by official sources. Blind quotes are sadly routine, as are misleading attributions, such as a senior State Department official when the speaker is the Secretary of State. But the notion of quote approval, so contrary to basic journalism ethics, shocked even old hands. Former CBS Evening News anchor Rather, who's been around the block a few times, called the practice a sellout, and he was not alone.
I think at this point, you're no longer talking about an interview, you're talking about a press release.
Edward Wasserman is the Knight Professor of Journalism Ethics at Washington and Lee University.
And if quotes are going to be used, it ought to be indicating that these are managed quotes, these quotes have been approved, they've been judiciously selected, they've been pruned, and this is no different from a press release. And what happens is Washington becomes no different from Beijing in terms of reporting what authorities want reported.
Either you're talking on the record or you're not talking on the record.
Mark Leibovich is chief national correspondent for the New York Times Magazine.
Any sort of post-facto negotiation is bad, and it's going to, one, be a big annoyance, and two, it changes the power dynamic of what we do in an area in which we have increasingly less power. So I think it's something that we should hold on to very tightly.
On the other hand, he says, the current environment demands that reporters weigh the evil of having sources intervene in the reporting process against the evil of not having access to the people in power. And more than once, he's opted for the access.
I do it probably more regularly than I should. I would love there to be some kind of blanket policy that the New York Times puts in place that I could hide behind. Or actually just sort of wield as a tool, because I don't like to do it. I would like to do it less. I would like to do it not at all.
Among the other news organizations playing the game are the Washington Post, the Huffington Post, Bloomberg, Vanity Fair, and Reuters. In the aftermath of the Times story by reporter Jeremy W. Peters, one organization said it takes no part in such negotiating. That would be the Associated Press, whose spokesman Paul Colford declared that the AP wants no part of, quote, the rinse cycle. We spoke to AP's Washington bureau chief, Sally Busby.
I talk to my reporters about these issues all the time, and they have a very clear idea of what we expect from them. It is a guideline that the reporters are expected to follow, and I'm pretty confident they do.
Busby, however, was less unequivocal than the AP spokesman. She acknowledged that negotiations over on-background material get pretty convoluted.
I think that we work really hard not to get manipulated by people. But campaign coverage in particular is a battle between the media and the campaign. It's a battle. It's a full-throttle battle. The media wants to find out as much as it can about what the candidate is really like, what they're planning to do, what their positions are, what decisions are going to make. And the campaign has an absolute interest in controlling its message and its timing and all these kinds of things.
It is a classic power struggle. But you might ask, what is everybody so afraid of? The campaigns desperately need the media to get their talking points out, and the media need the access. Why can't everybody just get along? Here's why.
Well, I think you hit a reset button for the fall campaign. Everything changes. It's almost like an Etch-a-Sketch. You can kind of shake it up, and we start all over again.
That was Romney campaign spokesman Eric Fernstrom back in March being caught in a truth. He was answering a question about whether the nominee would move closer to the political center after the hard right primary. But the observation that Romney could simply erase a primary's worth of stated positions was exactly the sort of gaffe pounced on by the press and the Obama campaign that has both camps paranoid about what slip of the tongue, misstatement, or other careless remark might jump up to bite them. Shame on them for strong-arming the media into revisionist journalism, but shame, too, on the media for fixating on the trivial gotchas that so obsess them. Professor Wasserman.
We need to acknowledge that one of the sad facts about this is the degree to which election-related news has become so denatured and so circumscribed and so oriented to the utterances of campaign managers and trying to catch them in inappropriate remarks that they've sort of forgotten that what election is about is what the public, what the electorate thinks.
But what if news organizations just refused to play by other people's rules? What if they just said no? Ian Trainer is the European editor for The Guardian. Years ago, in reporting a story in Germany, where quote approval is required for every utterance by every public official, he refused on deadline to submit quotes back to the German Minister of Defense.
And we just told the story, and I just told the defense minister, sorry, we don't agree to your conditions, and that's that.
When the story did not appear the next day, the defense ministry came groveling back with an apology. Because they had plenty of power to throw around, but they did not have the power of the press. Raw, unedited quotes can be very potent, which is why they make campaigns so nervous. But that power and immediacy is what the podcast Blank on Blank is aiming for. Often, print journalists record their interviews and then transcribe small portions from the tape for the final piece. Most of it is never heard again. But Blank on Blank returns to those interviews and excerpts compelling portions for everyone to hear. Founder and executive producer David Gerlach got the idea while thinking back on his own work as a print journalist.
There's all these great asides, outtakes, and you never got to use them. Maybe you'd use a few quotes. And as I eventually met more and more journalists, they thought about these interviews that only they got to hear. And I thought that, you know, we could bring these to life.
Let's have a listen to what some of these outtakes sound like. This is a fellow by the name of Bono in an interview with former Rolling Stone writer Anthony Boza.
What was the question again? Just
most memorable personal encounter.
Okay, well then, with my father, as I
I slept beside him in his last weeks and hours.
Hmm.
And his last words, which were, "Are you all mad?"
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Oh, good Lord.
You get to hear the reporter's reaction and get a sense of the dynamics of an interview.
Exactly. It's just a different dynamic than whether it's in a television studio, a recording studio. There's a phone call. I like to say that you're a fly in the wall. We only use things that are on the record. We obviously are very respectful of that, and we use things in context. You know, this isn't TMZ. We're not looking for gotcha moments.
Let's hear a bit of tape from Jonathan Alter, now of Bloomberg, then of Newsweek, in an interview he had with the newly elected President Barack Obama.
That was a big deal because it really set the tenure, the tenor for the entire year. And I think it's fair to say that that helped to create the teabaggers and empowering that whole wing of the Republican Party.
Whoops. He said teabaggers instead of Tea Party, which set off just a whole cascade of opprobrium from Fox News and the political right. That was a gotcha moment. When it was in print, you know, it sounds even gotcha-ier.
With Jonathan, I thought it was interesting to talk about the art of interviewing a president. You know, anything you say during an interview can be used in a political context. One quick note about that interview with the president, you can hear him tapping his finger on the table over and over and over again during different points in the interview.
Does blank on blank take advantage of the fact that people are perhaps less on guard and who would maybe handle things a little differently if he or she were to know that the tape in raw form was going to show up on the internet?
Individuals like the president or, you know, rock and roll stars, they know what they're doing. These are stories they're willingly telling. We're not taking anything out of context. We're not using things that are off the record. So I feel pretty strongly about the fact that the journalists recorded it. And there's nothing different than if they went forward 10 years ago and said, oh, I had a great quote from so-and-so, and I used that in a new story.
So here are Chris Elliott and his father, Bob Elliott. Chris Elliott, the comedian and actor. Bob Elliott, the comedian from Bob and Ray from the 50s, 60s, and into the 70s.
Did you leave your job at the office, at the studio, or would you come home and joke around with each other?
Well, we all joked with each other, I think. It was a very happy childhood.
Well, I can remember trying to impress you with, you know, my sense of humor and sometimes succeeding, sometimes failing.
What fascinates me about that is I can hear the difference between these two men speaking to a reporter for a print piece without any of the performance that goes with a broadcast interview.
Yeah, it's father and son sitting back and talking about, you know, their upbringing. I just love what you can hear when it's just three people talking versus cameras rolling. It's something different that I think is really special.
What's the difference between print interviewing and broadcast interviewing?
It's a different intimacy. You have more time usually. You know, when we would have interviews at Good Morning America, you had 4 minutes, 5 minutes to do an interview. When you're sitting down with someone across a table in a cafe, you've got an hour. You can kind of wind into that big question you want to ask or that big story you want to hear about. So I think that's the biggest difference. You have kind of a comfort level that you can build, really hear things you normally wouldn't get to hear.
Well, David, thank you so much.
Thank you.
David Gerlach is the founder and executive producer of Blank on Blank.
And now for a few of your letters. I'm in the enviable position of not having been here for the last few weeks, so these are all about Bob.
And most of the negative ones concern an interview I conducted with researcher Brendan Nyhan about the debate over Mitt Romney's role at Bain Capital after 1999. Doug Hayden writes, quote, "Nyhan was clearly suggesting that the Obama campaign has been misrepresenting Romney's involvement with Bain, and only those who have not followed the story closely would disagree, and further, that the media have fallen down by allowing this misrepresentation to stand. I strongly disagree. My take on the story is that there is clear evidence that Romney had formal legal involvement with Bain as a result of the reported SEC filings.
Similarly, Peter C. from Katy, Texas writes, quote, I have no doubt that Romney did not have day-to-day operational control, but as sole owner and CEO, I think he can be held responsible for the company's strategy. In my view, day-to-day operational control was a straw man argument that Bob should have recognized and challenged.
I also aroused some ire in my discussion of binging on AMC's critically acclaimed series, Breaking Bad. I watched 33 episodes in 3 days. Michael Taylor wrote, quote, like a real meth junkie, you just holed up and kept snorting every last grain of the magic powder until it ran out. This doesn't make you a bad person, Bob. But, says Taylor, binging on just about anything is unhealthy in every possible way. He goes on to admonish me for encouraging binging in others, but concludes by saying, quote, I still love your insights and commentaries.
Bob, you might as well finish the letter.
All right. And look forward to the return of Brooke to add her voice to the conversation.
Keep sending those emails to onthemedia@wnyc.org or posting comments at onthemedia.org. And don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name and how you miss me.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the Internet. More at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness. On the web at melvilletrust.org. And the SCAN Foundation, committed to aging with dignity and independence. At thescanfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. They say that smell is the most evocative sense, but a team of Virginia Commonwealth University students would disagree. They're a design team that calls themselves Brendan Chilcutt, and their creation is called the Museum of Endangered Sounds, a website that catalogs the incidental noises made by old technologies. In their mission statement, which they attribute to Chilcutt, they say they launched the site to, quote, preserve the sounds made famous by my favorite old technologies and electronics equipment. They warn the reader, if you don't understand my passion and the significance of my work, you probably never will. OTM producer PJ Vogt understands. We asked him to explain why he gets verklempt when he hears the chirrups of 1990s technology.
For people born before, say, 1985, there's a universe of outdated technologies to feel nostalgic toward. It's cliche to list them, but let's just do it anyway. The crackle of vinyl, the hiss of FM radio, the ring of an old phone. It's sort of like at some point we all got together as a culture and agreed that these would be our audio shorthand for a bygone world. When a movie scene starts with a stylus on a record, 73 men sailed up from the San Francisco. We know whatever happens next takes place in a better, more golden age. But let's say, hypothetically, that you were born around 1985. Here's a sound that actually fills me with genuine, achy longing. That's a 56K modem making a connection. As soon as I hear it, I remember sitting in my parents' attic, dialing and redialing, trying to get a connection through AOL's constantly overloaded servers. I remember feeling that teenage anxiety of missing out, sure that whatever my friends were talking about online was vital and important. The modem sound gives me all of that. The difference is, unlike a vinyl hiss, a modem sounds awful. It's not pretty or warm or musical. It's an electronic jangle. And most of the sounds of 90s technology are like that. Windows 95 chimes awake with all the majesty of a drunk lounge piano. Disk drives hum a film score of office tedium. And old video games beep and bloop, relentless and obnoxious. For me, that's what's transfixing about a museum of endangered sounds. Not that they're pretty, but that they're ugly.
Beep, 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 beep.
It's a testament to our ability as human beings to fall in love with anything, no matter how noisy. There's nothing we can't miss when it's gone.
The music you're hearing is a three-person collaboration. First, Jimmy Jufri, a pioneering clarinetist and bandleader. The second is Rena Schwartz. It's her high heels you can hear echoing in the lobby of a midtown Manhattan office building over 50 years ago. And the third is her husband, Tony Schwartz, who made the recording. This is just one of over 30,000 Tony Schwartz recordings. He was a man obsessed with hearing and preserving sound until his death in 2008, when we first ran this piece. That he recorded so much is all the more remarkable for the constraints under which he did it. Tony Schwartz.
I'm not able to travel far. I have agoraphobia. And in walking, I could just go around my postal zone in the midst of Manhattan. And the postal zone was New York 19 at that time. That was the area I could travel in.
What he lacked in range, he made up in depth, using a new recording device he built himself in 1945.
I made the first portable tape recorder. I brought the VU meter from inside the case to the top so I could look down at it and see how loud things were. I put a strap on it so I could have it over my shoulder. I could go record children in the park doing jump rope rhymes, and I made 14 records for Folkways Records.
When his recorder was mass-produced, he struck a deal with those who bought it. Send me your sounds, and I'll send you mine. And they did. And when he wasn't dealing strictly in sound, he used his ear to inform his other vocation, TV advertising, much of it political. He's best known for the so-called Daisy ad he made for Lyndon Johnson in the 1964 race against Barry Goldwater, that of a young girl pulling off and counting daisy petals, a sound that dissolved into a man counting down to an atomic blast. And that was all just still a small part of Schwartz's extraordinary legacy as a media theorist, author, record producer, Broadway sound designer, advertising exec, and folklorist. In this piece, the Kitchen Sisters, Davia Nelson and Nikki Silva, reflect back on Schwartz and a life spent listening.
I won't go to Macy's anymore, more, more. There's a big fat policeman at the door, door, door.
I was interested in the sound around us.
Two things that you're not allowed to carry in taxi cab. One is fish, the other is bedding.
I had a wrist mic. I had a brush lapel mic, and I would put it on a wristwatch band, and I'd pull it out my sleeve. So I would just walk around and record that way. Like when I went into the pawn shop and I did cab drivers, that way I recorded about 700-800 cab drivers.
Do away with your parking lots in Midtown from 14th Street to 59th Street. No parking allowed in the daytime, only after 6 o'clock.
I had recorded the songs on jukeboxes in the restaurants or bars that catered to the various groups around my postal zone. What I would do is get people in the restaurant who spoke English to come over and translate it for me.
The country in which I was born is suffering many, many back economic things. Even though I'll feel terrible there, in my country there are always flowers. That is my paradise. I won't change Puerto Rico by 60 New Yorks. I won't change Puerto Rican chickens by frozen chickens in the ice boxes here.
This is Max Nichols of Pietermaritzburg, Natal, South Africa, calling Tony Schwartz of New York, USA.
Hello, Tony Schwartz. I'm bringing you greetings from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
This is a Greek folk song from island of Crete.
Hello, Tony. My name is Thomas Knott, and I come from Killarney, Conakry Island.
When I got my first wire recorder, I asked the company if they would give me the guarantee slips from people from all over the world and all over this country who bought the recorders, who said they were buying them because of their interest in music. And I would exchange wires with people in other countries who were interested in folk music, and they would send me material from their countries.
My name is Tony Schwartz. The music you hear is a Peruvian Indian playing his guitar on a quiet summer evening. This is one of 15,000 recordings I've collected, recordings of folk music and folklore, recordings I've exchanged with people all over the world.
Hello, Tony. I received your letter here the other day. Well, I'm going to send you a wire now, this stuff that I generally do, you know, singing the cowboy stuff. I don't know if you fellas in New York City appreciate this kind of music that we folks around here do, this hillbilly stuff.
That's how it started. Recordings came in from all parts of the United States, from all parts of the world. Recordings on wire, recordings on tape. One of my exchanges was with a man who wanted sounds he no longer heard.
Tony, I wonder if you'd do me a favor. I live out in the country, and originally I came from the city, and I kind of miss it. And I was wondering if you would record some sounds of the city and send them out to me. I'd really like to hear it. How about it?
Part of my answer was recorded in Times Square.
Bus going right out. Chinatown, Loney, all Greenwich Village on the bar. The Empire State.
A week later, I found this in my mailbox.
Tony, I received your sounds of the city this morning, and I've been playing them ever since. I noticed that you said that you recorded them about 8:30 at night. To sort of reciprocate, here's the sounds of my country, 8:30 at night.
The voices and music of the world came into my apartment in New York City, and I traveled no further than my mailbox. 15.
In people talking, there's an innate musicality in the way certain people speak, and also in the barkers at nightclubs or various places.
Sold for a dollar.
The sound of selling used to be the people, vendors going by in the street, or people singing in the backyard or shouting in the backyard. Now it's over the radio or television. I did a whole record on the sound of selling. Vegetable men shouting, apples, apples, on the street, or that horse and wagon selling vegetables.
My mule is white, my charcoal is black. I sells my charcoal.
There were men who would go around buying old clothes, and they'd yell, I cash clothes, I cash clothes.
Charcoal, charcoal.
I did a radio program on sound once a week on WNYC for over 35 years. I would do it on any subject that came up to me during the week. How'd I come to these ideas? Just from being human and working with sound and knowing how sound affected me and affected other people.
Here lies Tony Cherney, once a pet turtle of Daryl Cherney, died February 24, 1964.
Who died?
My turtle, Tony. He got a sore shell and he tried to save him by giving him hamburger, but he died, and we're gonna bury him.
How do you feel about it?
Not too well. Sort of a tragedy for me. I'm gonna play taps, and the flag is because I like him. Just like the President of the United States when he died, except, but he's like in my family. Okay. Give me the turtle. Bye.
Come to me, my melancholy baby. Cuddle up and don't be
Can a baby feel blue?
Anybody can feel blue. All your fears are foolish fancies, maybe.
Well, I was born at the beginning of time. Time magazine started the year I was born. Harry Belafonte was a bop singer when I met him. I got him into the Jamaican songs.
This is another working song. It is the banana loading song. Day-o, day-o, day-da-light-a me wango.
I met a woman who was a cashier at Macy's, and her name was Louise Bennett, and she knew all the Jamaican folklore. And I played those songs to Harry Belafonte.
Schlaf, mein Kind, schlaf, geside.
Good morning. Today, I'd like to play two beautiful songs sung by Paul Robeson.
I think he was one of the great singers of our time. And in the McCarthy era, Robeson couldn't travel because they called him a communist, which is ridiculous. He wasn't a communist. He just believed in internationalism. The ridiculousness of this McCarthy era, you know, he started the whole thing of loyalty oaths. Most people think of evil as the sounds of gunfire or thunder or lightning or something.
You, as a witness, if you conduct yourself like
I found and believe that the most evil sounds in the world are the sounds out of mouths of people.
We have concluded and unanimously.
How much more of life burden can I bear?
I've used media to shame people into proper behavior. In primitive cultures, if someone did something shameful and word of mouth got around the village in an hour or so, in our culture, the same thing exists. But if you divide the distance of our country into the speed of sound, you find it would take a 64th of a second to reach across the country by telephone, radio, television, or anything like that. My brother built a one-tube radio, which never worked, and I used to go up in the attic and play a spaceship like Jack Armstrong. I was also interested in physics, and the physics teacher was interested in amateur radio, and I first built my own receivers and huge 20-meter antennas, and I built my own little shack where I had 16 by 16, and I had my radio station in the front, my bed in the back, and I ran a telephone line up to the house so my mother could call me in for supper. I made up shortwave listener cards. I speak to them on the radio, and I would tell them how they're coming in. I think the most important thing we can work on in communication is to make the world safer for the people who live in it. People, that's what I was most interested in. People and their life and what they do.
This reflection on Tony Schwartz was produced by Davia Nelson and Nikki Silva, the Kitchen Sisters.
That's it for this week's show. On the Medium was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary, with more help from Amy DePiro and Eliza Novick-Smith, and edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson, Our engineer this week was Andrew Dunn.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. And you can email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Hey, Brooke, what's this sound?
Are you striking a match?
Lighter. Lit my cigar. Okay. What's this one?
You're tearing paper.
Exactly. How about this?
You've just fallen asleep?
Nope. That's the sound between Edited By and Brooke.
Bye, Bob.
Bye, Brooke.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.